Hello, this is Cheryl, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 6th issue of the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the headlines, Trump team puts a target on Cuba with threats and oil blockade. President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio have made clear that the collapse of Cuba's communist government is not only a likely side benefit of Maduro's ouster, but a goal. By Karen DeYoung and David O'Valley. No place was hit harder than Cuba by the shockwaves that Saturday morning's U.S. military seizure of Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro sent through Latin America and the world. Within hours of the operation, long before the government in Havana acknowledged it, phone calls and texts across the island spread the news that dozens of elite Cuban security forces had been killed guarding Maduro. By the time it finally released a statement late Sunday saying that 32 of its military and security personnel were dead in Caracas, the Cuban government had bigger problems on its hands. Both President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio made clear over the weekend that the collapse of Cuba's communist government was not only a likely side benefit of Maduro's ouster, but a goal. "I don't think we need to take any action," Trump said as he flew back to Washington from his extended Florida holiday break. "Without Maduro and the oil supplies Venezuela provided," he said, "Cuba looks like it's ready to fall." Rubio went further, indicating that the United States might be willing to give it a push. "I'm not going to talk to you about what our future steps are going to be," he told NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. But he added, "If I lived in Havana and I was in the government, I'd be concerned." Their words resonated with many in the Miami-centered exile community, where the struggle to free Cuba from communist rule has dominated politics for decades. On Saturday, South Florida Cuban exiles, some wearing red Trump hats and Cuban flags as capes, joined hundreds of revelers at spirited impromptu celebrations from Little Havana to Doral, a city nicknamed Dorelizuela because of its large population of Venezuelans. Cuban American leaders, most of them Republican, issued statements as Venezuela coverage dominated local TV stations. "Cuba is the root of problems with Venezuela, Nicaragua, and other leftist regimes in the region," said Dariel Fernandez, Miami-Dade County's elected tax collector. "Now the time has come for the Castro communist and socialist assassination regime to be held accountable as well, and for the Cuban people to finally be free." Absent direct U.S. intervention, however, Cuba experts here and on the island were less certain. "If you're asking if the Cuban government will just collapse on its own because the economic pain is bound to increase without shipments of Venezuelan oil, I'm very skeptical," said Michael Bustamante, associate professor of history and director of the Cuban Studies program at the University of Miami. "To keep the lights on and cars running, Cuba has long been dependent on Venezuelan oil supplies, for which it has exchanged security and medical personnel in a sympathetic contract with leftist allies in Caracas. I would be very well proven wrong, but Cuba has been here before and survived," Bustamante said, referencing what is known in Cuba as the special period that began in 1991 with the abrupt cutoff of outside assistance after the demise of the Soviet Union. Juan Gonzalez, who served as Western Hemisphere Director on the Biden administration's national security staff, said that cutting off oil deliveries is going to put a huge squeeze on the humanitarian situation in Cuba, which is already suffering regular electricity blackouts and food scarcities. "But I don't think the regime is going to cry uncle." Aside from an economic uptick during the Obama administration, when the resumption of diplomatic relations between Washington and Havana led to increased tourism and slender openings for private ownership and outside investment, the Cuban economy has never really recovered from the Soviet fall. The nation has been on a steady slide into economic chaos for years, owing to U.S. sanctions and what even many of its supporters see as mismanagement by a sclerotic Cuban Communist Party. Some chose to see opportunity in the darkness following Maduro's ouster. Carlos Alzugaray, a retired career Cuban diplomat reached by phone at his Havana home, said there is, of course, an increase of threat, a very bad thing. But it was possible, he said, that Cuba's allies in Russia and elsewhere would help, and just maybe the government will open up the economy and do what the economists have been telling them for a long time, and they have refused to do. Venezuelan support under Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, in the early 2000s, helped Cuba emerge from the special period and the weight of decades-long U.S. sanctions. Since then, Havana has weathered the death of revolutionary leader Fidel Castro, COVID, Trump's dismantling during his first administration of the limited Obama opening, and furious street protests in 2021. But the emboldened second Trump administration presents an entirely new threat to Cuba's leaders. At various points over the years, Cuba's own government economists have advised overhauling the economy and have been urged to do so by allies in China, Vietnam, and Russia. Raul Castro, who took over from his ailing brother Fidel in 2006, warned of needed reforms in a lengthy 2010 speech to the Cuban parliament. "We're playing with the life of the revolution," he said. "We can either rectify the situation or we will run out of time walking on the edge of the abyss and we will sink." But his plans to expand the role of the private sector and reduce state ownership were seen as contradictory and insufficiently implemented, ultimately resolving few of Cuba's systemic problems. Other pushes for change have run into similar roadblocks over the ruling party's refusal to allow private businesses and farms to sell their goods directly for market prices. Its rejection of currency reforms, heavy government investments in a failing tourism industry, and the growing power of GESA, the military-controlled conglomerate that runs vast swaths of the economy. At their peak of about 100,000 barrels a day, Venezuelan oil shipments allowed Cuba to serve its own energy needs and sell refined petroleum products overseas for desperately needed cash. But as Venezuela dealt with sharp drops in output due to U.S. sanctions and mismanagement, shipments dropped to about 30,000 barrels last year. Those cuts, along with Cuba's aging refineries, failing infrastructure, and the occasional hurricane, led to at least 5 island-wide blackouts last year. "They have to realize they can't depend on foreign help anymore," Alzugaray said. Russia and Mexico have supplied some oil, although Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum is likely to come under increasing U.S. pressure to cut off aid to Havana. China, which holds major Cuban debt, has shown little interest in helping. "Reforms have been approved on paper," Alzugaray said. "The problem is they don't do it. The essence is opening to market economics, allowing expansion of the private sector, and eliminating or selling socialist state enterprises that don't produce. They have to do it, and they have to do it fast. They have lost too much time." Few Cuba watchers have much confidence that reforms will happen, at least under the party government of President Manuel Díaz-Canel and the current power structure. "There are reformers inside the regime," said Gonzalez, the Biden administration official who had extensive dealings with the Cuban government. "They have a vision, but they don't have the wherewithal and the influence to have it done." "Even if they did," he said, "it won't be enough for Rubio, whose parents fled the island before Fidel Castro's 1959 takeover, and Cuban-American lawmakers and power brokers," he said. "They're going to want big change." Opposition on the island is diffuse and leaderless since arrests following the 2021 street protests. "People who aspire to be opposition leaders are either in Miami or in Madrid or in jail," said William Leo Grande, a specialist in Latin American affairs at American University. A Venezuela-like removal of even a handful of individuals is unlikely to rattle the multi-layered entrenched party and military power centers to the point of collapse, he said. As for Cubans themselves, Al Zugare said, I wouldn't think that people are so desperate that they will welcome an American intervention or a group of Miami Cubans taking over. What people want is the Cuban government to change, he said, but in Cuban terms, not imposed by the outside. Continuing from the headlines, the data center rebellion is here, and it's reshaping the political landscape. As the build-out of AI infrastructure alarms communities, it is fast emerging as a potent electoral issue across the political divide. By Evan Halper. Sand Springs, Oklahoma. One float stood out among the tinsel and holiday cheer at the annual Christmas parade here, an unsightly data center with blinding industrial lights and smoke pouring out of its roof, towering menacingly over a helpless gingerbread house. This city bordering Tulsa is a battleground, one of many across the country where companies seeking to build massive data centers to win the AI race with China are coming up against the reality of local politics. Sand Spring leaders were besieged with community anger after annexing an 827-acre agricultural property miles outside of town and launching into secret talks with a tech giant looking to use it for a sprawling data center. Hundreds of aggrieved voters showed up at community meetings. Swarms of protest signs are taking root along the rural roads. It feels like these data center companies have just put a big target on our backs, said Kyle Schmidt, leader of the newly formed Protect Sand Springs Alliance. We are all asking, where are the people we elected who promised to protect us from these big corporations trying to steamroll us? The people who are supposed to be standing up and protecting us are standing down and caving. From Archbald, Pennsylvania to Page, Arizona, tech firms are seeking to plunk down data centers in locations that sometimes are not zoned for such heavy industrial uses within communities that had not planned for them. These supersized data centers can usurp more energy than entire cities and drain local water supplies. Anger over the perceived trampling of communities by Silicon Valley has entered the national political conversation and could affect voters of all political persuasions in this year's midterm elections. Many of the neighbors fighting the project in Sand Springs voted for Trump 3 times and also backed Republican Governor J. Kevin Stitt, who implores tech firms to build in his state. We know Trump wants data centers and Kevin Stitt wants data centers, but these things don't affect these people, said Brian Ingram, a Trump voter living in the shadow of the planned project. You know, this affects us. Ingram was standing before a homemade sign he planted on his front lawn that said, Jesus was born on ag land. The grassroots blowback comes from deep red states as much as from left-wing groups such as the Democratic Socialists of America, which have helped draw hundreds of residents to hearings in Arizona, Indiana, and Maryland. Even Energy Secretary Chris Wright warned data center developers that they are losing control of the narrative. In rural America right now, where data centers are being built, everyone's already angry because their electricity prices have risen a lot, he told energy executives assembled in Washington for the North American Gas Forum last month. I don't want them in my state is a common viewpoint. Some industry groups argue that residents' concerns are misplaced. Fueled by misinformation, driven by radical environmental policies, communities are missing out on the jobs, security, and opportunities this technology is delivering, said an email from Brian O. Walsh, executive director of the AI Infrastructure Coalition. The group says the projects lower electricity prices, a claim that is hotly disputed. The White House frames the data center boom as beneficial, saying in a statement that it will lead to big investments in infrastructure and boost manufacturing. But the administration is also aware some communities oppose them. Communities know what's best for them, and the administration is clear that local infrastructure decisions remain with states and localities, the statement said. Many local politicians are yielding to community pressure and rejecting data centers. Between April and June, more projects were blocked or delayed than the previous 2 years combined, according to Data Center Watch, a tracking project by the nonpartisan research firm 10A Labs. Some $98 billion in planned development was derailed in a single quarter. Earlier this month, a group of Senate Democrats launched an investigation into the role data centers are playing in increasing electricity prices. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent, Vermont, last month called for a moratorium on data center construction, warning the tech firms are draining scarce energy and water reserves and pushing the cost onto everyday Americans in pursuit of AI technologies that threaten to displace millions from the workforce. White House AI czar David Sacks replied on X. He would block new data centers even if states want them and they generate their own power. But advocates say residents' concerns are legitimate. This data center expansion affects so many issues, said Mitch Jones, managing director of policy and litigation at Food and Water Watch. The group this month organized a letter signed by several large national advocacy groups demanding a moratorium. It takes up farmland in rural communities. It takes up dwindling water sources in communities that need cleaner drinking water. And it is driving up electricity prices for everyone, he said. It is drawing together people from disparate backgrounds who might not agree on other political issues. They are saying this is taking place without any forethought to communities, and we must stop it. The NAACP this month convened a two-day Stop Dirty Data conference in Washington that focused on the impacts of the AI buildout on minority and low-income communities. It included a bus tour of Data Center Alley in Northern Virginia, the world's largest collection data centers. Even Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, is championing an AI Bill of Rights to enshrine local government's power to stop data center construction and prohibit utilities from pushing AI infrastructure costs onto residents. The break between Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican, Georgia, and President Donald Trump was driven in part by her vocal criticism of his AI buildout push. The industry has struggled to quell the concerns. In Chandler, Arizona, former Senator Kristen Sinema, independent, co-founder of the AI Infrastructure Coalition, implored city officials to get on board with a large proposed project or risk the federal government pushing it through without city input. The city council rejected the project unanimously. The vote followed the Tucson City Council's unanimous rejection of a plan which would have required annexing land in the Sonoran Desert that until June had been zoned rural homestead. Some voters were outraged that local officials had signed a 5-year non-disclosure agreement with Amazon, which did not come to light for 2 years. Frustration with the power company that would have provided the power has fueled a movement to drive it out in favor of a community-led nonprofit. Amazon did not respond to questions about the controversy, saying only, "We do not have any commitments or agreements in place to develop this project." Amazon founder Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. People are understandably asking how they will benefit, said Chris Lehane, Chief Global Affairs Officer at OpenAI, which has won initial local approval for some of the country's largest data center projects. He said companies need to listen to communities and make sure they are sharing in the economic gains. You need to be on the ground having these conversations. It's a journey. In some places, large tech companies have signed contracts committing to pay for new power grid infrastructure required to bring a data center online, even when the companies are not the only ones that would benefit from it. It's a journey that some local officials are willing to go on because the projects generate construction jobs and boost revenue for schools. "We're trying to work through this," said Mike Carter, the city manager in Sand Springs. "This would probably be one of our major employers. It would almost certainly become the dominant part of our tax base. When you can surpass Walmart, which is right now the biggest taxpayer in our community, there is a big incentive to look at this." He has tried to assure residents that they will have all their questions answered, including the name of the tech firm, before the city hearing this month, where officials will consider rezoning the sprawling property from agricultural to industrial. He said the city has signed other non-disclosure agreements during negotiations with large corporations, such as Olive Garden. The project developer, White Rose Partners, said none of the costs involved with providing electricity to the Sand Springs data center would fall on residential ratepayers. The firm says the data center would generate millions of dollars in revenue for local schools and services. "It is cold comfort to many residents of the rural community where the data center would industrialize a landscape now defined by the ranches that drew them there. I don't care how much chocolate icing you put on a dog turd, it didn't make it chocolate cake," said Rick Plummer, who raises elite team roping horses next to the proposed data center. "They are trying to fluff this data center thing up and say, man, eat this birthday cake. But it isn't birthday cake." On the other side of Tulsa, a steady stream of pickups pulled off the busy local road to sign petitions fighting a different data center proposed for the rural community of Coweta. One sign takes aim at the non-disclosure agreements, saying, "NDAs betray." The petitions demand the firing of a city official who signed one. "We want to see this damn data center go away and go someplace else," said Alan Prather, who was leading the petition drive dressed as Santa. "This town deserves a better centerpiece than a data center. They keep coming to smaller and smaller towns. Leave mine alone." Sherry Crumpacker, a retired law enforcement officer who pulled over to sign, concurred. "I moved here from California to get away from BS like this," she said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the health section, ADHD drugs work, but not the way experts thought. Ritalin and Adderall don't act on the brain's attention circuitry, a study found, by Mark Johnson. The stimulants Ritalin and Adderall have been used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, for decades, but research shows they don't act on the brain's attention circuitry as had long been assumed. Instead, the medications primarily target the brain's reward and wakefulness centers, according to a new study published in the journal Cell. The research, which used brain imaging data from almost 5,800 children ages 8 to 11, also pointed toward the important role that lack of sleep plays in the disorder. "When I first saw the results, I thought I had just made a mistake because none of the attention systems are changing here," said Benjamin Kay, one of the study's authors and a professor of neurology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. "It's not that the stimulants are ineffective. The paper clearly shows that they help," said Nico Dawson-Bach, another of the authors and a professor of neurology at the university. "They help kids who have a diagnosis of ADHD do better in school and do better on tests, and they help kids who don't sleep enough, and a lot of Americans don't sleep enough. Although ADHD is often thought of as a childhood condition, an estimated 15.5 million American adults have the diagnosis. Roughly half of them received the diagnosis in adulthood. The disorder afflicts an estimated 7 million children ages 3 to 17. The prevalence among American children rose from 6.1% in 1997 to 1998 to 10.2% in 2015 to 2016, according to one study. The exact cause of ADHD remains unknown, and there is no single test for the condition. Despite the name, attention deficit, ADHD is a multifaceted disorder in which difficulty focusing attention is just one component, said Maggie Schweitzer, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine, who did not work on the study. It is important to remember that ADHD is not a benign condition. Individuals with ADHD are not only at risk for school problems in childhood, but also for occupational, social, and physical and mental health problems across the lifespan. For many people, these medications are transformative. The brain images used in the Cell paper published last month came from children enrolled in the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development ABCD study, which began in 2015. Researchers compared images of children who took prescription stimulants on the day of their scan with those of children who did not take stimulants. By studying the connections that allow different regions of the brain to communicate with one another, the scientists discovered that stimulants were promoting increased activity in the wakefulness and reward regions, but not in the attention ones. Dosenbach said the stimulants pre-reward our brains and allow us to keep working at things that wouldn't normally hold our interest, such as a class in school that feels like drudgery. The stimulants are not a cognitive booster, Dosenbach said. They don't make you smarter, I don't think. They don't actually give you better attention. Researchers found that the stimulants not only helped children diagnosed with ADHD, but also those who had slept less than the recommended 9 hours a night. But the stimulants did not lead to better school performance by children who did not have ADHD and were not sleep deprived. Psychiatrists said there are some non-stimulants used to treat ADHD, such as automoxetine. The new study supports an increasing body of research that has pointed toward lack of proper sleep as a contributor to ADHD. Sleep disturbances are incredibly common in ADHD, impacting about 3 out of 4 children and adolescents with the disorder, said Jessica Lunsford Avery, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine, who was not involved in the study. It is increasingly clear that clinicians and families should view ADHD as a 24-hour disorder. Unfortunately, sleep problems are rarely recognized or adequately treated in children and adolescents with ADHD. Sinan Omar Turnakioglu, interim division chief of neurodevelopment pediatrics and neurogenetics at Children's National Hospital, said that while sleep medications can be prescribed for children with ADHD, it is also important to address behavioral management, including limiting light exposure and time in front of a computer screen before bed. He suggested that people have some kind of winding down bedtime routine to really decrease the level of stimulation prior to going to sleep. Turnacioglu and other experts stressed that giving prescription stimulants such as Ritalin or Adderall to children is not the same as giving them 5-hour energy shot. The prescription stimulants, he said, don't work in the same exact way in the nervous system. Schweitzer said the study suggests that clinicians and families should be discussing sleep, behavioral strategies, and medication options to address ADHD. Max Wisnitzer, a professor of pediatrics and neurology at Case Western Reserve University's School of Medicine, and a member of the board of directors for the nonprofit Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, CHADD, said research has shown that the condition can shorten life expectancy. Because they're impulsive, they don't necessarily make good choices, Wisnitzer said. They don't remember to take their medications. They sometimes eat too much. There's more obesity, more cardiovascular disease, more diabetes. From the opinion section by Leanna S. Wen. 10 health stories that could define 2026. The year ahead promises new healthcare innovations alongside major changes to public health policy. As 2026 gets underway, health policy is entering a period of consequential change that will affect who can access medical care, what it costs, and how the nation approaches public health. Here are 10 issues I will be watching closely in the year ahead. 1. GLP-1 medications. These medications have already transformed obesity care, and new evidence continues to expand the list of conditions they may help address. Last month, the Food and Drug Administration approved the first oral GLP-1 for weight management, and the Trump administration has signaled plans to increase its availability. Major questions for the year ahead include whether an oral option meaningfully increases uptake, whether pricing and insurance coverage shift enough to expand access, and what new data emerge, including how patients might taper treatment over time without losing benefits. 2. Healthcare affordability. The Trump administration has emphasized efforts to rein in prescription drug prices, and 2026 will be an early test for whether those policies translate into real savings for patients. Meanwhile, independent analysis project that millions of Americans could lose health insurance coverage as premiums rise and federal protections narrow. How these forces play out will be a defining policy tension. This question is closely tied to the explosion of GLP-1 therapies. While these medications can be life-changing for many, paying for them on a larger scale could overwhelm the current system. 3. Vaccine policy. It is abundantly clear now that Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is dismantling long-standing vaccine policy at an unprecedented pace. Consequential changes to the childhood immunization schedule are already underway, with Kennedy announcing sweeping revisions on Monday that cut the number of diseases covered by routine childhood vaccination from 17 to 11. With hand-picked advisors in place and no permanent director at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, traditional safeguards have largely fallen away. The best hopes are state health officials and independent medical organizations offering their own evidence-based guidance. How hospital systems, insurers, and clinicians respond will have profound implications for vaccine access and public trust. 4. Infectious diseases. In 2025, a measles outbreak in Texas infected more than 800 people, and another spike is now taking place in South Carolina. The immediate questions are how soon the United States will lose its hard-earned measles elimination status, and which diseases will reemerge next as vaccination rates fall. Cases of whooping cough and tetanus are already increasing, and as the COVID-19 pandemic made painfully clear, the danger lies not only in familiar diseases, but also novel pathogens. How much latitude federal health agencies will have to respond to both remains an open question. 5. Improved diagnostics. Against a backdrop of growing public health concerns, there are also bright spots. Advances in diagnostics stand out among them. new tools such as blood-based tests for colon cancer and self-collection for cervical cancer screening point toward a future of earlier detection and fewer barriers to care. Still, some new diagnostics carry new risks. Whole-body MRI scans and blood tests purporting to detect any kind of cancer carry high false positive rates, leading to unnecessary anxiety and expensive follow-up care. The challenge is not just developing better tests, but figuring out how to deploy them responsibly. 6. New life-saving treatments. Previously untreatable conditions are becoming increasingly manageable thanks to gene therapies, such as those for sickle cell disease and neuromuscular conditions. These complex treatments remain extraordinarily expensive, but they have already saved the lives of patients who previously had few or no alternatives. In 2026, the crucial question is whether these therapies can move beyond isolated successes and be delivered at scale. Transplanting animal organs into humans is another frontier. A few patients have survived pig-to-human kidney and heart transplants, but none have yet achieved durable long-term success. Still, progress has been steady, and the first such transplant with sustained function could occur soon. That could fundamentally alter prognoses for people with end-stage organ failure. 7. Artificial intelligence. Healthcare has emerged as one of the most concrete and productive arenas for artificial intelligence. AI tools are already widely used to aid diagnosis, guide treatment decisions, streamline administrative work, and empower patients. Expect that footprint to grow this year, especially as the federal government embraces AI. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services will soon use AI for insurance authorizations, and the FDA is incorporating AI into drug evaluation and approval. Whether efficiency gains translate into better health outcomes remains to be seen. 8. Limits on social media. Amid greater recognition that excessive social media use is harming children, Australia has moved to prohibit social media access for those under 16, and other countries are considering similar measures. In the U.S., many states and school districts have taken more targeted steps, such as banning cell phone use in classrooms. Even where outright bans are politically or legally difficult, regulatory attention can shift norms and highlight the consequences of constant digital exposure. 9. Cannabis policy. The Trump administration's decision to ease cannabis restrictions could significantly expand the drug's market in 2026, even as mounting evidence underscores the harms of regular use and undercuts claims of benefits. Key issues ahead include developing reliable ways to detect and deter cannabis-impaired driving, regulating marketing to clearly communicate risks, and providing treatment for the millions of users who have developed addictions to cannabis. 10. Tried and true lifestyle management. In an age of new technologies and influencer-driven wellness trends, it's worth remembering that the approach is backed by decades of evidence. In 2025, a large study on dementia prevention reaffirmed that the most effective ways to protect brain health are familiar: regular physical activity, good nutrition, social connection, and staying mentally engaged. These are all proactive steps that individuals can take themselves. As federal health priorities shift and public health protections weaken, personal and community level investments in health will matter more than ever. From the body section, this fun hobby may reduce your dementia risk by 76%. There are several science-based ways to boost your brain health, but this one might surprise you. Column by Tricia Pesricha, MD. What are the best ways to keep my brain sharp as I age? There are several science-based ways to lower your risk of dementia, but one especially fun option might surprise you: dancing. Dancing combines some of the best elements known to be associated with longevity: exercise, creativity, balance, and social connection. You're investing the same time as walking or other exercise activities, but may be getting much more out of it. In fact, one study found that people who danced frequently, more than once a week, had a 76% lower risk of dementia than those who did so rarely. In the early 1980s, a group of researchers at Albert Einstein College of Medicine set out to better understand the aging brain by recruiting almost 500 men and women ages 75 to 85 living in the Bronx. Each person underwent neuropsychological tests and responded to questionnaires about their health and lifestyle. Then, over the next couple of decades, the researchers tracked the people's cognition. Perhaps not surprisingly, the scientists found that for every cognitively challenging activity performed one day a week, there was an associated 7% reduction in dementia risk. The more often people tested their brains, such as with board games or crossword puzzles, the less likely they were to develop Alzheimer's or vascular dementia. But when it came to physical activity, one hobby stood out above the others after controlling for other life and health style factors: dancing. The researchers, who published their findings in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2003, concluded that physical activities such as swimming and walking also trended in the right direction, but that their results were not as profound as those associated with dancing. Because people in the early stages of dementia may cut back on activities like dancing, the study was designed with a long period of observation to correct for this. Physical activity, especially aerobic exercise, in general is wonderful for our brain health, and this isn't intended to knock walking. A small randomized control trial of walking versus ballroom dancing among older adults found both activities benefited memory and learning. But combining physical activity with creativity and cognitive challenges may help protect the brain further. Dancing asks your brain to do several things at once: match a rhythm, remember steps or quickly improvise new ones, navigate space, and perhaps even respond to a partner. While more studies are needed, the data suggests that this degree of cognitive multitasking gives your brain the right kind of workout. Dancing may also boost balance and strength. Dancing is simply music-based movement, ideally of a kind that makes you feel good and involves the company of others. And it can truly be for almost everyone. In my own clinic, we recommend dancing as therapy for patients with movement disorders like Parkinson's disease. Even among people who already have dementia, limited studies indicate regular dancing boosts cognitive scores. Besides brain health, there are other great reasons to consider shaking a hip. In a 2020 meta-analysis of 29 randomized trials among healthy older adults, found that social dance-based activities were associated with a 37% reduction in risk of falling, as well as improvements in balance and lower body strength. Three simple ways you can become a dancer. Try something new to find what's right for you. You might learn that this whole time you thought you had two left feet was simply because you were born to salsa and not Charleston. Look for online dance classes. While many community centers offer dance classes specifically for older adults, often for free, I know that dance classes suited to your interests and needs are not always easily available nearby. The world of online dance classes blossomed over the pandemic, and personally, I cannot get enough. Where else would I have found my true calling? Modern Bollywood dance lessons, but online? There are also several classes on YouTube tailored to possible physical limitations and needs. As always, check with your physician before starting a new exercise routine. And don't write off video games. Of course, let's not forget video games about dancing. Who else was a star at Dance Dance Revolution? Similar games have actually been studied among older adults and found to improve executive function with effects lasting as long as a year. Just playing music can help too. Even if you're not up for dancing, there's still power in playing your favorite tunes. A large population study published recently found that just listening to music most days was linked to a decrease in dementia risk. Music can invoke memory and emotions, but certain kinds of it can also offer a distinctly enjoyable challenge to the brain. As you listen to music, your brain is constantly evaluating its predictions regarding what comes next. Will the next note and beat be the one you are anticipating? A potent driver of the urge to groove is syncopation. When music is syncopated, meaning you expect to hear a loud beat in line with the rhythm, but instead it's weak or there's a quick pulse of silence, it challenges our brain's expectations. Think Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones or Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars. Syncopation creates an exciting sense of push and pull in the music. Humans perceive songs with a healthy dose of syncopations as more pleasurable. Studies have found that those syncopations strongly compel us to bust a move, completing that gap our brain is craving to fill. What I want my patients to know. There's no magic bullet to prevent dementia. Cognitive changes are the result of several factors converging in our brains: our genetics, lifestyle, stress, diets, and environmental exposures. Walking and other forms of physical activity can help boost your brain health, but doing so shouldn't feel like a chore. Cognitive strength can also grow out of many activities that give us great joy. Moving to music you truly love, sharing space with someone else's company, and trying something new without worrying about how you look doing it. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And from the Economic Policy section, Congress has 4 weeks to dodge another shutdown. Appropriators are rushing to complete full-year spending bills before the January 30th deadline. By Riley Begin. Lawmakers are back in Washington this week for a four-week sprint to finish funding the government before the current spending law runs out on January 30th. If they fail, they will need to pass another short-term extension or spark another government shutdown just 2.5 months after the last one, the longest funding lapse in U.S. history. Funding the government usually requires passing 12 individual bills. Lawmakers approved 3 as part of a deal to end last fall's shutdown, and they also extended current funding levels for the rest of the government into January. Those levels were last set in March 2024. But it will be challenging to finalize the remaining bills, which have not yet been formally negotiated between the House and the Senate or approved by congressional leaders. The two Appropriations Committee chairs, Representative Tom Cole, Republican, Oklahoma, and Senator Susan Collins, Republican, Maine, announced in late December that they have finally reached an agreement on the total spending level they'll shoot for in the remaining bills. They did not reveal the overall cost, but Cole said it is lower than the amount if Congress were to pass another funding extension, known as a continuing resolution. This pathway forward aligns with President Donald Trump's clear direction to rein in runway, beltway-driven spending, Cole said in a statement. We will now begin expeditiously drafting the remaining 9 full-year bills to ensure we are ready to complete our work in January. From there, appropriators must navigate political pressures from their right and left. Fiscal hawks, including many in the conservative House Freedom Caucus, insist on funding levels for most agencies should not be higher than the last fiscal year. I believe that we should begin to control our federal deficit. and runaway federal debt by keeping this year's discretionary spending level at or below last year's level, said House Freedom Caucus Chairman and Senior Appropriations Committee member Representative Andy Harris, Republican, Maryland, in a statement. But Democrats must approve any funding agreement, which has to receive at least 60 votes in the Senate to bypass the filibuster. Republicans control the upper chamber, 53-47. Senator Patty Murray of Washington, the top Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, slammed the chamber's newly released Homeland Security spending bill in December, calling it partisan and pledging to fight for accountability in Trump's out-of-control DHS. The Senate has spent weeks attempting to pass a five-bill appropriations package that had only been negotiated in that chamber. The bill needed consent from all 100 senators to advance, and several conservative senators held up action for weeks over billions of dollars in earmarks tucked into the bills. The House proposals also include billions in earmarks. Those senators eventually relented, and the chamber was poised to vote on the package right before leaving town for the winter break, but two Democratic senators blocked it, demanding funding be reinstated for the National Center for Atmospheric Research, a Colorado-based research organization that Trump has moved to eliminate. The Senate package would tie together two major government funding bills covering defense, labor, education, and health and human service agencies, with three other bills to fund the Departments of Interior, Transportation, Housing and Urban Development, Commerce, Justice, and science-related agencies. It would appropriate $1.3 trillion, making up the vast majority of discretionary federal government spending. Cole has said that the Senate's five-bill package would be too big to pass the lower chamber. He suggested passing the remaining nine appropriation bills in three separate bill packages in January when lawmakers return, beginning with bills covering the Commerce and Justice Departments, the Interior Department, and agencies covering energy and water. The political minefield ahead may mean lawmakers once again turn to a funding extension rather than face another shutdown. I don't want another CR. I don't think Mr. Cole wants another CR, said Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee. Let's go. Let's get the bills done. Congress is supposed to pass all 12 appropriations bills before government funding runs out at the end of each fiscal year on September 30th. But lawmakers' inability to adhere to that process is not new. Congress has only passed all its spending bills before the deadline four times in recent decades. Instead, most spending bills in modern history have been approved in one big package known as an omnibus right before the holiday break. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican, Louisiana, pledged to stop that practice. The political complications of passing 12 bills separately, however, has made that difficult to achieve. Instead, lawmakers have extended funding levels first approved under President Joe Biden multiple times, and Republicans have passed supplemental spending for their immigration and defense priorities through a party-line tax and spending bill. And from the opinion section, America invents these drugs. Why doesn't it make them? Producing generic drugs safely in the U.S. should be a federal priority. By Richard L. Jackson. Richard L. Jackson is the founder and CEO of Jackson Healthcare, the parent company of USA Antibiotics. The United States leads the world in pharmaceutical innovation, but is less successful in manufacturing generic versions of the very same life-saving medicines it invented, often leaving Americans' treatment dependent on foreign companies whose drug formulations and processes undergo little regulatory scrutiny. Lower-cost generics now represent 9 out of 10 prescriptions filled in America, yet the vast majority are made overseas. After America's last remaining manufacturer of the widely used antibiotics amoxicillin and amoxicillin clavulanate filed for bankruptcy in 2020, my company bought and refurbished the plant for $38 million, and it looked like the worst decision in my 40-year career in healthcare. Since reviving production of these and other penicillin class antibiotics, U.S. antibiotics has been fighting heavily subsidized foreign drug makers to compete and survive while providing the level of quality American patients deserve. Now the U.S. government is finally taking decisive action to support domestic manufacturers of critical generic medicines. In June, the Food and Drug Administration announced a pilot program to expedite the typically year-long review of medicines when they aligned with national priorities. On December 9, Augmentin XR, one of the most reliably effective extended-release antibiotics ever developed, was announced as the first drug approved for sale under the accelerated FDA framework. Its imminent return to pharmacy shelves marks the first time since 2011 the drug has been manufactured domestically, and credit for this goes largely to President Donald Trump. Beyond the FDA pilot program, his administration has elevated supply chain security to a national priority and pushed federal agencies to move with urgency when essential products faced risk. Why should this be a federal priority? Antibiotics such as amoxicillin and Augmentin, which combines amoxicillin with clavulanate to reduce antibiotic resistance, form the backbone of modern medicine. These bacteria-killing drugs treat community-acquired pneumonia and acute bacterial sinusitis in adults and children. They treat the ear infections and cases of strep throat that send millions of children to pediatricians each year. Without these drugs, routine surgeries, high-risk procedures, minor infections can turn deadly, and cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy face life-threatening complications. Furthermore, unlike conventional antibiotic formulations requiring three daily doses, the extended-release version of Augmentin requires only two. Clinical research demonstrates that patients on twice-daily regimens are significantly more likely to complete their antibiotic courses than those on three-times-daily schedules. Better adherence means better outcomes. In 2020, U.S. Antibiotics made a deliberate decision to invest in bringing essential antibiotic manufacturing back to American soil and under American safety oversight. That required long-term capital in an extremely low-margin business. But the FDA's fast-track pathway is helping to make that investment more viable by shortening the time to market. In manufacturing, time and scale matter. Faster, predictable approvals reduced carrying costs, stabilized production planning, and make domestic supply competitive over time. Of course, one product will not fix the system, but Augmentin's XR's return is likely to be the first of many important drug releases built on three principles: expanding fast-track FDA pathways for priority drugs, using drug acquisitions for the strategic national stockpile, and other federal programs to reward domestic manufacturing, reliability and quality over lowest price, and making long-term demand commitments to stabilize essential generics. If the United States wants patients to have reliable access to essential medicines, it must be capable of making them at home. Trump was right to elevate domestic manufacturing and supply chain security as national priorities. The FDA's fast-track approval of Augmentin XR shows this strategy can work in practice. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the January 6th issue of The Washington Post. Your reader has been Cheryl. Thank you for listening.